This is Cincinnati Edition. I'm Jay Hanselman with Howard Wilkinson. Each day brings us closer to the midterm elections in November, but there are other headlines and stories taking some attention away from the fall races. Joining us, as he does once a month, is political junkie Ken Rudin. You can join our conversation. The number is 513-419-7100, or email us at talk@wvxu.org. You'll also find us on Facebook and Twitter. Good afternoon, Ken.
How are you, Jay?
I'm well, and you?
I am fine. I'm just getting my driver's license today.
All right.
I've been driving 10 years without one.
We'll get to
Did
hold
you
that
have
thought.
Temporary permits?
Yes, a learner's permit.
Okay. Hold that thought. We'll get to that topic All a little right. later. But I suppose you have a trivia question to start out with.
Well, speaking of Ed Fitzgerald, I mean, he is the beleaguered Democratic candidate for governor of Ohio, and of course his stock seems to be plummeting as of late. So my question is, since World War II, what candidate for governor in Ohio got the lowest percentage in the general election?
Since World War II, what candidate in the Ohio governor's
major party candidate
got the lowest vote total, lowest percentage total in the race?
Right.
In the governor's race.
In the governor's race.
Well, Howard has already written down an answer.
This is...
he wrote down an answer, and as a matter of fact, he wrote down a percentage. So,
oh, wow. Unless I missed something here.
That was
Did he
fast.
Write down what I was wearing? Does he know everything?
One more time on the question, then I'll give the phone number.
Since World War II, the lowest percentage for an Ohio gubernatorial major party candidate.
Howard thinks he knows the answer. If you think you know the answer, 513-419-7100. Again, 513-419-7100. I wasn't going to start there, but since we're talking about the Ohio governor's race, Howard, I'll put that to you first. What do we make of this week's activities in the Ed Fitzgerald campaign?
Well, I mean, the last several weeks have not been good, obviously. You know, there have been the story about the woman in the car in October 2012 at 4:30 in the morning. Out at some
wife.
Industrial site, not his wife, a woman who was apparently a member of an Irish delegation that was in town on some trade mission. And, you know, he said it was an innocent thing that he was, you know, she had gotten separated from her party and that they were trying to find their way back to their hotel. You know, Kasich hasn't said a word about it. He doesn't have to. I think the worst part was then it came out that Ed Fitzgerald did not have a permanent driver's license from 2002 until 2012. He had a series of temporary permits, but he didn't have a real driver's license. And this man was a mayor at the time, the safety director of a suburban city, Cuyahoga County executive. Just seems kind of odd.
Ken, you're outside the state. What's your take on Ed Fitzgerald?
Well, obviously, John Kasich is somebody with greater ambitions, greater aspirations, we mm-hmm. think. Of course, he made an abortive bid for president in 2000. That didn't go far, but there's some consideration that now that he's term limited, he may be looking at the White House. And this is also a race where the Democrats would have loved to have taken him down. He's a national figure. The Democrats never were really crazy about him. And they thought that Fitzgerald was a decent candidate. And for the longest time, the polls showed it within reach of the Democrats winning. But lately, I mean, I think, first of all, the economic numbers in Ohio are improving. Kasich is taking credit for that. And his numbers, he still showed a size of, you know, he's been showing a growing lead over Fitzgerald. And now, as Howard says, between the woman in the car at 4:30 in the morning and the failure to have a valid driver's license for 12 years or 10 years or whatever it is, people are bailing on his campaign. His staffers are bailing. Money people are bailing. And again, this, you know, not only could bring down Fitzgerald, but it could bring down other Democrats running as well. And that's what the party is fearful of the most.
Do you think if Kasich wins this in a big way, then sometime after January, you start seeing him show up in places like Iowa and South Carolina and New Hampshire?
I do. I mean, they have, you know, of course, when you think of the Republican field, the prospective Republican field, you talk about, you know, the Ted Cruz's and the Rand Paul's and Marco Rubio and maybe Scott Walker. But a lot depends on the midterm elections. A lot depends on how everybody does. Rob Portman's name has been mentioned more and more. So you just wonder what's going to happen in November. But I would think that a landslide victory, if that's what happens with Kasich, could have him and other national political journalists talking about him as a perhaps an aspirant for higher public office.
Howard, let me put this to you first. I believe it was an article, first part of the week, maybe in the Columbus Dispatch, that Democratic leaders huddled with Ed Fitzgerald, I think, over the weekend, perhaps in Columbus. Mm-hmm. They were talking about strategy. I think one thing that was discussed was to go heavily negative against John Kasich. So what is the strategy for the Fitzgerald campaign and Ohio Democrats?
Well, the strategy, as I can see it, is, I mean, they're going after Kasich on job creation. And, you know, yes, jobs have been created, but they're much lower paying jobs than many of these people held prior to the recession. And that John Kasich has basically helped, you know, the wealthy few, his friends, you know, people in the upper income brackets, and left the middle class behind.
I'm Ken, too. I guess the fear the Democrats have there, too, though, is if they go too far negative, that could actually help John Kasich.
Well, you just wonder what sometimes the negative campaigning really, really works. I mean, one of the classic examples is during the Watergate year of 1974. Nobody expected Jim Rhodes to beat, who did he beat? Was it?
Jack Gilligan.
Gilligan, right? Governor Gilligan. Nobody expected that to happen, but he did by running a very negative campaign and just stunned everybody. But of course, it could backfire as well. But I was thinking what options the Democratic Party in Ohio has. You know, we saw the instance in Montana not too long ago when the appointed Democratic senator there, John Walsh, who was accused of plagiarism, he was just overwhelmingly negative press coming out of that, and he just quit the race. And he said, okay, I'm not running. And then the Democratic Party put up a candidate in its stead. Now, with only 75 days or so until the election, I don't think that's feasible, but I just wonder if the Democrats might be better off with a replacement candidate, because this right now it looks like that Fitzgerald is in big trouble.
Howard, let me ask you about that, because I think, aren't they past the deadline could happen?
They are past the deadline for that to happen. You know, somehow, I mean, if it got really bad, Fitzgerald could suspend his campaign, but his name is on the ballot. It's going to be on the ballot on November 4th.
Could they direct more of their resources to down ticket races, perhaps for state auditor, state treasurer, attorney general?
Well, that's possible too. I mean, you know, they think that they still have a shot at some of these other races. You know, state treasurer, maybe attorney general, maybe secretary of state. But you know, there is the fear, as Ken mentioned, that Fitzgerald, with a very weak showing, is going to drag down the rest of this ticket.
Was there any national Democratic money that would have been targeted for the Ohio governor's race? And with what's happening, are they going to leave him and transfer that money to somewhere else where it might have more of an impact?
Well, it's odd. I mean, you know, the Democratic money nationally hasn't come into Ohio. You know, Republican Governors Association has been running ads in Ohio. Most of their ads have been, you know, now they're starting to be, you know, negative ads towards Fitzgerald, while Kasich is running campaign ads that are, you know, nice and warm and fuzzy and tell his life story and tell what his values are, and they sound good and they look good.
And, Ken, I would assume that with Fitzgerald's troubles that it makes it less likely that some of the Democratic superstars, like perhaps former President Clinton or even current President Obama, will likely be skipping trips to Ohio?
Well, I know that President Obama's dance card is not full at all. There are a lot of Democrats who are really running away from him in many, many states, even states he carried in 2012. There are Democratic candidates who say, well, I'd rather not have the president out campaigning for me. But Bill Clinton seems to be still the star. I mean, actually, Elizabeth Warren is pretty much of a star, too. But it depends. You know, it's of course, gubernatorial races don't have the same pull nationally as Senate races do. But I suspect that Democrats are going to just avoid the Buckeye State.
Yeah, I think that's true.
Could this be Howard headed toward, I believe it was 2006, that when Ken Blackwell was running against, I hope I got my year right, Ken Blackwell was running against Ted Strickland, and Blackwell conceded before the first vote was ever counted after the polls closed at 7:30.
Well, that's true. Yeah, it's hard to predict. We are 75 days out and things can happen. But as it stands now, that's conceivable, but... you know, we'll just have to wait and see.
This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. We're talking today with political junkie Ken Rudin, and we will continue our conversation after a short break. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. Joining us today, as he does once a month, to talk about politics, the issues, and the candidates, is political junkie Ken Rudin. You can also join our conversation, 513-419-7100, or email talk at wvxu.org. We're also on Facebook and Twitter. Again, 513-419-7100. And we're trying not to keep Ken too tied up today since he has a learner's permit. I think later this afternoon he's going to go out and practice parallel parking. Ken, one more time on your trivia question.
What was the name of the woman Howard Wilkinson was with at 4:30 in the morning?
That's a bonus question.
What was the lowest percentage since World War II, the lowest percentage reached by a major party gubernatorial candidate in the general elections?
And Jim from Fort Thomas has been patiently holding with what we think is an answer to that question. Jim, go ahead.
Yes, thank you. I may get the pronunciation wrong, but I'm going to guess Rob Birch.
Rob Birch, Ken.
Well, that's hard to get that pronunciation wrong, but that is the correct answer.
And Howard got it right.
Okay.
And Howard, Jim, too.
Howard, what percentage did you put down?
Well, actually, it was like 24.99.
That's right. Yeah. That's right, 25%. 1994 against George Voinovich, who's much easier to pronounce than Bob Birch. But anyway, the question is whether Fitzgerald will reach the 25% Birch did in 1994.
Right. Well, you know, the funny thing about that is, too, that at the time, you had to hit that 25% threshold in a gubernatorial race to be considered under Ohio law a major political party. So they came very close to not being a major political party in the state of Ohio.
But yes, that's true. But then, that's amazing how it happens. We're talking, I was just thinking at the conversation we were having before about whether the Democrats have a shot at winning any statewide offices in 2014. And yet, not too long ago, was it 2006 when the Democrats won everything, except I think maybe the attorney general or something. But so the political fortunes can come and go very, very quickly in state politics.
Yes, all right, Jim, very good. Hold the line there, and someone to get your information, and we have a wealth of fabulous prizes that will be headed your way.
Okay, thank you very much.
And thank you. Howard, how can you remember 24.99?
Jay, I was there. I was writing about it. I was like, staying up all night waiting to see how far this thing would drop.
Right. I think Howard.
When do I get my prizes?
It's in our fine print.
Howard was a member of the Birch Society back then.
Howard, you fall into the fine print that employees of Cincinnati Public Radio are ineligible.
I guess that's right. I guess that's right. Yeah.
Sorry about your luck.
Okay.
Well, Ken, let's move on to the other topic that certainly has generated lots of news coverage: the situation in Ferguson, Missouri, and of course, we know for the most part the details there. But what are the broader national political implications of what we're seeing in Ferguson?
You know something, I honestly don't know. It's fascinating that once again President Obama feels the need, and he's probably right, needs to weigh in on what's going on there. But no matter what he says, everybody seems to be disappointed. Either many in the African-American community say he's just too timid, too reserved. Why isn't he as outspoken as Attorney General Eric Holder? And then there are others who just say that, you know, nobody's paying attention anymore. The fact is that when he interrupts a vacation in Martha's Vineyard to have a press conference, whether it's the beheading of an American journalist in Syria or things like that, Iraq or something like that, it just things aren't going well for him. It's not that he's, remember when Bill Clinton in 1995 was talking about his relevancy. I don't think it's a question of that, but I just kind of think that it just seems the president seems weary and the country seems weary given the day in, day out of what's going on in Ferguson. And, you know, what's interesting to me about Ferguson is that there's no question about the thought of an unarmed black 18-year-old being shot six times or whatever it is by a white cop. I mean, that has to be investigated. That is just unacceptable. And yet, of course, it does happen so many times. We always think of these these cases where blacks are just shot in the street, you know, by white cops, and there's an old outrage. But if there's been such conflict in Ferguson for decades, given the fact that it's become an overwhelmingly black city and it still has an overwhelmingly white police force, why does it take the shooting and the tragic death of a young man for people to pay attention? Whereas, you know, apparently these conflicts, these tensions have been going on for a long, long, long time. And why do you have to wait until something like this happens to send in, you know, the governor and people like that and say, okay, we have to fix this situation? Why wasn't it fixed before that if there were all these tensions? That's the thing that jumps out at me the most.
Well, I mean, that was, you know, back in 2001, a similar incident happened here, and there was some, you know, pretty bad nights on the streets of protests and rioting, and it ended up with the police had put in a basically a court-ordered plan to change the way they deal with the community. But do you think that sending Holder there helps at all?
I don't know what helps. Obviously,
I mean, some people think that Obama himself should be there.
Well, you know, I mean, you know, the funny thing is, not the funny thing is, but when the situation on the Texas border, when all these thousands of migrants from Central America were crossing the border, and they asked, you know, several people suggested that the president go down there, and he says, well, I don't believe in doing photo ops. And that's kind of a weird thing for the president to say, considering, one, he has been doing photo ops for 6 years of his presidency, but two, that, you know, this is what's on the front page of every newspaper. This is what people are talking about. This is what is a pressing need. And, you know, you always think of George W. Bush looking at Katrina from the window of Air Force One, and you don't want, if I were an advisor to the president, I wouldn't want to be seen as equally distant in a case like Ferguson. I mean, just coming out from his, you know, Martha's Vineyard and making a speech about, well, you know, a la Rodney King, we all need to hug each other, that's not going to work. And I think that sending Holder is the right thing, but maybe the president just needs to get his, again, we keep saying this over and over again, every now and then he needs to roll up his sleeves and get his fingers dirty. And sometimes he's just not seemingly willing to do that.
Well, I know, you know, every president takes vacations, and occasionally these kind of events take place during those
It always
vacations.
Happens when you're on vacation.
That's
exactly.
Right. And, you know, the James Foley tragedy was another one in which, you know, he had to come out, make a statement, but then, you know, was criticized for then going back to the golf course, you know.
There was a scene in Fahrenheit, the movie Fahrenheit 9/11, I don't know if you remember this,
right,
which is where George W. Bush is out on vacation, and he talks to the cameras, and he says, we've got to stop the terrorists, we've got to stop this, you know, these terrorists from doing these horrific things. And then in the next breath, he says, now watch this shot, and he takes a golf swing. And people say, oh my goodness, how do you have that within seconds of each other? And somehow, you know, that's one of the first scenes that I was thinking of when the president went from talking about Foley or Ferguson or anything like that, and then suddenly playing golf again with one of his pals. Look, every, as you say, presidents do take vacations, and everybody needs vacations, certainly the president of the United States. But I do remember in the first Bush administration, these T-shirts, which I still have, it says George Bush's Anywhere But U.S. Tour, and it shows all the vacation plans, the places he's gone to. So when Republicans take vacations, the Democrats criticize, and when Democratic presidents take, I mean, basically, whoever is the president and is taking a vacation during this horrific time gets criticized, and probably unfairly, but that's the way politics is being played.
I think there was a, I believe it was in the New York Times, there was an article about the Ferguson situation. It had a picture of President Obama and Attorney General Holder essentially saying that part of the problem and conflict there is they're not on the same page concerning the response in Ferguson.
That was a fascinating article. I think basically the White House disagrees with the conclusion of that article, but what it says was Holder comes from a more race-conscious background. He's just more, he comes from the civil rights battles of the 60s, and he feels very strongly that more than words need to happen. And whereas the president, who is much younger, who is 10 years younger, seems to be more reflexive, more sitting back, more saying, well, you know, we've all got to, you know, hold hands and get together on this. So there is an interesting dynamic between Holder, the first African-American attorney general, and Barack Obama. But the fact is that Holder seems to be much more aggressive on issues of race, a situation where many African-Americans thought that the president would take the control of since his election in 2008.
With the situation, Howard mentioned it briefly with James Foley and the video of essentially his execution. Clearly, that's a foreign policy issue. Does that play in any way into the 2014 midterm elections, or is that more these foreign policy issues with Syria and Iraq and also the situation in Ukraine, Israel, and Hamas? Is that more something that's more forward-looking to the next presidential election in 2016?
I think, if anybody's going to criticize the president's foreign policy, and a lot of people have, I don't think that the tragic, the death, the execution of Foley is going to be a particular issue in 2014, but it does fill in, it does become part of the narrative that there are things out there, as you mentioned, Ukraine and Syria and Gaza and things like that, where the president either is not acting or fearful of acting or saying, well, what else could we do? The nation is so war weary. And then, you know, foreign policy basically becomes that kind of issue. So it's kind of, you know, you just wonder whether foreign policy is going to be the kind of issue that it could be.
Well, I mean, the fact is, though, that ISIS is holding other Americans.
There are
three other Americans threatening to kill them.
Well, and then the question is, do we do what the European governments are doing? And basically, whenever ISIS takes a European hostage, the European governments bail them out with millions of dollars in ransom. And the president said, we're not going to do that. And of course, then it leads to the question whether the president is doing enough to free these Americans who were held hostage. And then it came out yesterday that actually we did try, the U.S. did try to free these hostages back in July, but we dropped some people there via helicopter and we just couldn't find them. But I mean, the president is saying that we're trying the best, that we're doing the best we can.
But the fact is, I mean, this could go on for some time then.
Well, everything is going to go on. You know, look, once upon a time we were out of Iraq, and now we're bombing Iraq again.
Right.
So, you know, just like Gaza. I mean, what we're seeing now in Gaza is something we've seen 10 years ago, 20 years ago, and 30 years ago. And I don't know how a president could change that dynamic. I mean, you talk about conversations with Israel. You talk about conversations with the Palestinian Authority, but nothing seems to get done. And of course, sometimes the president rightly or wrongly gets blamed for it. And in this case, President Obama's foreign policy is being seriously questioned by almost everybody.
Someone wants to know about the, why would there be a release about the story on the failed rescue attempt for those hostages in Syria? My assumption is perhaps a news organization was ready to report it anyway, and the White House beat them to it.
Well, it's either that or the fact is that, you know, there are a lot of people saying, why didn't the president, why hasn't the administration done more to free these hostages? And I kind of think that what the White House was responding to is that, look, we're doing the best we can, and here's a perfect example. But, you know, either theory makes sense, but I kind of think it was a reaction to that.
But in the end, you think that the fact that Obama has, for the most part, been holed up in Martha's Vineyard, except for Sunday, I guess, he came back to Washington and met with Biden and some advisors. You think people are looking at him as irrelevant now?
No, not irrelevant. Just saying, well, why can't we get something done? I think that's the question. Yeah. I mean, you look at the rise of ISIS, for example. I mean, mm-hmm. the group that's responsible for the beheading. There are a lot of people said, well, if the United States had left some troops in Iraq, if they didn't support the Maliki government, which really disassociated themselves with the Sunni minority, and the resentment about that led to the groups like ISIS. So there are a lot of questions about how we conducted foreign policy and what led to this present situation.
That's something. Is there a news story in the fact that he left Martha's Vineyard on Sunday to come back to Washington? Apparently there's some reporting. Was it planned? Was it not planned? Is there something that's trying to be hidden, or is this, just something?
People wonder what was going on.
Well, who knows? I mean, I think the thing is that they just felt that having a backdrop of him with a open collared shirt in Martha's Vineyard, the land of the wealthy and the pretty, is not the kind of backdrop that the president wants to be part of when so many things are going wrong around the world. But as you say, 2 days later, he was back in Martha's Vineyard for more vacationing.
As we approach a presidential election in 2016, and there's a high likelihood that Hillary Clinton will be a presidential candidate, do these foreign policy issues, I would assume this sort of opens a door for her to sort of distance herself from President Obama and gives her a platform to run on?
Well, I mean, first of all, everybody remembers the interview she gave with The Atlantic a couple of weeks ago, where she basically said that the president has done, her foreign policy is much more muscular and more aggressive than his has been. And she had all these reasons where she disagreed with the president on so many things, the need for kind of an overriding philosophy, which Obama doesn't have, and all those things. And then when the interview was published, Hillary said, oh, no, I really didn't mean it as criticism. And apparently the two of them, Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama, met on Martha's Vineyard. And she said, oh, no, I didn't mean any criticism by it. So it's one thing for her to say, look, I'm going to be different than President Obama in X, Y, or Z. But in the next breath, when you said, oh, no, I didn't, it's not the way it seemed, you kind of wonder if she is a profiles and courage kind of candidate or not. But ultimately, she can't run as a third Obama term. She's going to have to be her own candidate. And certainly on foreign policy, given what we saw of the two of them, the differences in 2008, I assume she does have her a foreign policy agenda that is different than the president's.
And she and her husband are going to Iowa next month.
I wonder why. I mean, I think the weather is supposed to be really nice there.
No, it's a steak fry. I mean, it's a Tom Harkin steak fry.
Tom Harkin is retiring he's been in the Senate for 30 years, a Democrat from Iowa, and he's been in Congress for 40 years. And for 37 years, he's held this steak fry where all the Democrats, prominent Democrats from around the country come and get noticed and schmooze and all those things. And this year this is September 14th, and this will be Harkin's last steak fry. And the guests of honor are Bill and Hillary Clinton. And it's interesting, Hillary Clinton has not stepped foot in Iowa since the time she lost. Actually, she finished third in the caucuses to Obama and that wonderful guy from North Carolina. So she finished third to Obama and John Edwards. But this is the first time she's coming into the state since then. And there has been some grumbling by some activists who say, well, how could you not be coming into Iowa, because we're very, very important and everybody tells us we're important and therefore we are important, so why aren't you here? Well, she's coming. And it's funny, I saw a quote from a Des Moines political writer who said, this is a sign, this could be a sign that she's running. Well, duh. I mean, you need a sign like that.
Thank you very much. That's
exactly
it,
right. You wonder why newspapers are dying.
I'm writing that down right now.
Exactly. Well, hold on. It's a sign that she's running. She's serious about running.
Okay.
As we talk about her potential presidential candidacy, apparently there's a sign that may happen. There's another presidential candidate we'll get to after the break that is having some run-ins with the courtroom. But for any of these candidates, what has to go into their calculation about making statements, for example, on the situation with James Foley and the situation that is going on in Ferguson, Missouri. There's been some criticism that some of these folks have been silent.
Well, you haven't heard much from either party, really, aside from this violence has to stop, the shooting of unarmed black people should stop, and you know, we should start talking to each other. But nobody's come up with a solution that I've seen. I mean, of course, we can talk about what Rand Paul is saying about overreaching mm-hmm. by the police. There seems to be a little schism in the Republican Party about how to deal with police excesses. Remember Richard Nixon in 1968, and to a lesser extent, George Wallace, always talking about law and order, always talking about support your local police. Well, you know, there's some questioning now by the libertarian wing of the Republican Party, saying that the excess police force is part of the excess in government authority, be it NSA surveillance, be it drones, be it police work. So there's a little questioning of what the of support for the police, at least in the Republican Party.
Well, Rand Paul made it very clear. I mean, he said, you know, the militarism in the in local police forces is something that has to stop.
Right, but that's part of it. And that shouldn't be a surprise, because that is part of his philosophy. It's
sure.
just that
mm-hmm.
an overreaching a government activity, and whether it's police force or, as I say, or drone activity, this is clearly objectionable to a libertarian like Rand Paul.
Right.
But Howard, let's look at that issue, though, here. I mean, our former Hamilton County Sheriff, Simon Lease, have written about when he would yes. go through parades with some of this equipment that the sheriff's office here locally had.
Well, yeah, I mean, he did. He had a complete arsenal. He had Army, Air Force, Navy, and Marines. You know, when he would go through a local parade, parading all this machinery and weaponry that he had, it looked like one of the old Soviet May Day parades.
Speaking of the Air Force, Connie Pillich, is that the one who's running for state treasurer?
Mm-hmm. Right.
She said, in one of her campaign things, she said, "I ran a tight ship in the Air Force." I don't know what that means. How do you run a tight ship in the Air Force? I'm concerned about that.
Very carefully.
Okay, very carefully.
We will ask her about that.
Today is our monthly chat with political junkie Ken Rudin, and our conversation will continue after a short break. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. This is 91.7 WVXU Cincinnati Edition. I'm Jay Hanselman with Howard Wilkinson. We're talking today with political junkie Ken Rudin, and again, you're invited to join our conversation. Perhaps you have a political question or want to make a political comment. 513-419-7100 or email talk at wvxu.org. We're also on Facebook and Twitter, 513-419-7100. Well, Ken, we don't want to get too far into the program without talking about the troubles for Texas Governor Rick Perry. Have you ever had your mugshot taken?
Well, there's a loaded question.
Exactly. Well, we'll talk about this on the
Are you going to plead the fifth?
Yes, right. I'm going to drink a fifth. Yeah.
So what do you make of Governor Perry's indictment by a grand jury?
I don't know. I mean, they say that the indictment says, the felony indictment says that he abused his office. And I think my first thought was, I mean, who does he think he is, Barack Obama? I mean, this is exactly what John Boehner sued the president on, abuse of his office.
Yeah.
What's interesting about the indictment of Rick Perry is that even the New York Times, which is usually not on the same page as Rick Perry, said that this just seemed like a bogus and overreach by the prosecution there. So having said that, you just wonder if this could help, you know, Perry's likely second presidential bid, because he's been pretty well received in Iowa, pretty going around the country, getting good reviews, good remarks. Although it's hard to imagine campaigning for president saying, I am under indictment, please vote for me for president. But at the same time, there are questions that the Travis County, which is Austin, Texas, the Travis County DA has been looking into this commission where Governor Perry has been making a lot of appointments, putting a lot of money in there, a lot of his pals on this commission. And you just wonder if there's some kind of a, you know, quid pro quo. So, of course, the governor was trying to get rid of the Travis County DA because she made a spectacle of herself when she mm-hmm. was arrested for drunken driving. And he said, well, you know, if you don't resign, I'm going to veto all the money that goes to your investigations. And when she didn't resign, he vetoed it. And that's where the indictment came. So you wonder if that was the reason he did it. Maybe there's some question, maybe there's some validity for an indictment like that. But for the most part, people are around the, you know, Democrats and Republicans saying this seems, you know, you're going to convict the governor for this. For many ways, this is basically what governors do. They threaten, they cajole, they you know, use their power and they lean on people. And whether that's good or hard-nosed politics or not, but is it indictable? And that's the question.
Yeah, especially in Texas.
Right.
What, and I was trying to, off the top of my head, I probably should have looked this up before I asked this question, but is there a governor's race this year in Texas?
Yes, of course. And Rick Perry, of course, is not running for re-election. He's the longest serving governor in Texas history. He's not running for another term, although he could have. This is the governor's race in Texas is between Greg Abbott, who's the state attorney general, and Wendy Davis, the Democrat who got national acclaim when she did that long pro-abortion rights filibuster before the state legislature there. It's still a Republican state, likely to keep the Republicans in office. But again, as we've noted for many, many times, the demographics are changing rapidly in Texas. And while the Democrats may not do well in 2014, it'll come the day where the Republicans will find themselves in the minority in Texas. And if they're not going to carry Texas, the question is where they will carry. So one of the complaints about the Republican Party, and I know I'm going off on a little tangent here, but one of the problems, the complaints about the Republican Party is that they have to realize that with the changing demographics, they're going to have to pay attention or they're not going to win anywhere in the country, given the rising electoral clout of Latinos and Asian Americans and people like that.
And these charges, though, against Governor Perry, these are rather serious felony charges. These are not like run-of-the-mill misdemeanors. I mean, they could carry some significant prison time.
5 to 99 years in prison if he's found guilty of the first felony charge, and I think 10 years for the second one. No, these are really serious stuff, and that's why even David Axelrod, the former top aide to President Obama, tweeted the other day that it seems sketchy to him. Now, it may be sketchy, it may not be sketchy, but it just seems like it was kind of interesting to watch Perry's face when he went in for the mugshot. I mean, he had this big smile as if this was a campaign poster he was posing for. It just seemed like he seemed very triumphant, and he may well win this thing. Remember, this is the same investigation unit that indicted Kay Bailey Hutchison, the former senator, and that was thrown out. They did this with Tom DeLay, and while Tom DeLay was convicted, it was overturned by the court. So you wonder if it is political prosecution or not, as Governor Perry claims.
Do you think he's a serious presidential contender, even before this?
I don't. I mean, every and I was talking on my political junkie show that I had, do every week. I was talking to an Iowa pollster a recent show, and she said that Perry is getting a lot of acclaim by his campaigns in Iowa, obviously after the disaster of his campaign in 2012. But there are so many more people out there, you know, as I say, the Rand Pauls who are getting all the attention, and the Ted Cruzes and the Marco Rubios, if they're running or not. So I think he still has a long way to go. And, you know, if you talk about money, well, a lot of the money in Texas, it may be being reserved for Ted Cruz, who may or may not run. So I don't know. You know, I think Perry's trying to make it more respectable, may try to get some retribution for what happened in 2012. But do I see him as a serious candidate? I don't. And I think this may complicate, even though this may backfire against the prosecutors and he may claim a victory ultimately, I still think it's not the kind of distraction you want, not the kind of headlines you want.
Yeah, I mean, he got a rousing reception apparently at the state fair in Iowa, but that's one event. You know, no matter what happens in this criminal case, you think he's still bottom tier.
Well, you know, it depends who runs. I mean, we're talking about who runs, who's going to run anymore. Everybody's saying, I mean, Jeb Bush is supposed to be top tier, but I'm not convinced Jeb Bush runs. Everybody's still talking about Chris Christie, and I'm saying, why are people talking about Chris Christie? I mean, aside from the George Washington Bridge problem, the finances, the budget in New Jersey is just going really sour. So, I mean, not that Hillary Clinton is going to win the nomination, win the presidency unopposed, but I'm still not convinced who ultimately does run, except for Rand Paul, and that seems like a definite.
What about Scott Walker?
Well, you know something. Of course, he is. He was the subject of a recall that he won, and of course, he became a national conservative hero because he beat the recall. But he has a very tough re-election battle. Mm-hmm. You know, you think of the two governors who were up in 2014, who were thinking of the White House, Kasich and Scott Walker. But Walker has a tough. She has a very attractive. I think her name is Mary Burke. She's a businesswoman who's a sharp campaigner. And right now the polls look dead even. So before Scott Walker can start thinking about 2016, he's going to have to start thinking about November 2014. And that could be pretty dicey.
Of course, in Kentucky, we have a Senate race between current Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell and Kentucky Secretary of State Allison Lundergan Grimes. It seems like, Howard, this week's headlines have been on... how much Grimes is paying for a bus.
Right.
And both of them showed up yesterday for a rare-faced joint appearance before the state's Farm Bureau, I believe.
Yeah, that's right. Well, I mean, they're going back and forth with each other, you know. They did at the Farm Bureau event, you know, Grimes saying that McConnell, you know, hasn't done anything for Kentucky in 30 years. And McConnell's argument that, you know, she's just a tool of Obama. You know, the bus thing, you know, I don't know how much traction that's going to have. Apparently, you know, the allegation is that she got a bus from her father's company, who's really not in the bus business, and is getting a break and paying a lot less than what, you know, what a standard campaign bus costs. Then there was an article that was critical of McConnell taking the president of CEO of Delta Airlines to the Senate dining room, which is a hard place to get into, and then getting checks from the CEO and his wife and the Delta pack. So, you know, all these stories are just flying back and forth, and it's, you know, like you can't even keep track of.
And there was another one where Senator McConnell's wife was on a philanthropic board that was advocating for the use of to stop using coal for power generation.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Oh, yeah, and they're fighting about coal.
Ken, from the outside again, what do you make of what you've seen so far in the Kentucky Senate race?
Well, I mean, everything you've just recounted, I've been reading about, and it seems like it's tons of tit for tat that it's been going, which is typical in a McConnell Senate race because it's always hotly contested, it's always bitter, it's always personal, it's always negative, and always, at least so far, McConnell has managed to win. I still think he does win. I still think I still think he's just going to pull it out in the end. And as Howard points out, he is really running against Barack Obama. And sometimes that could be such a lazy strategy that it's not necessarily going to work. But I still think that he does win in the end. But, you know, stranger things have happened. There have been even in a year where there may be a Republican wave. And I'm not convinced there is going to be a Republican wave, although they should pick up some seats. But even in a year when Obama is unpopular and the Republicans seem to be on the ascendancy, McConnell's losing. It could not be ruled out at all.
What I think since I believe the last time you were on with us was July the 31st, but who's counting? any primaries of note that have taken place or coming up that we need to pay attention to?
Well, I mean, there's been a bunch of stuff in. I think the big news in the August primaries is that once again, the Tea Party has failed to knock off Republican so-called establishment senators in Kansas with Pat Roberts, in Tennessee with Lamar Alexander. The Tea Party really spent a lot of money trying to beat those two, saying they're either out of touch, too moderate, too busy playing footsie with President Obama, but. But both Pat Roberts, and they didn't win overwhelmingly. It wasn't landslides, but they failed to knock them off. And as with Lindsey Graham, as with Mitch McConnell, the Tea Party, except for Eric Cantor in the Virginia 7th Congressional District, the Tea Party pretty much struck out in 2014 after having pretty successful cycles in 2010 and 2012.
Just let's rewind a minute here. You were talking about the Republican Senate races. You're not convinced that they're going to retake the Senate?
No, I'm not at all. I mean, they need six, but I mean, and they could very well do it. I certainly think they're going to win in Montana, and that's a beaut. Montana, South Dakota, and thank you very much.
Last month.
I've done that joke for 30 years. What do you mean last week? Yeah. And I've done it since I was in that car at 4:30 in the morning. South Dakota, Montana, and West Virginia, I think they pick that. That's a clear thing. Right. And they could win Louisiana, North Carolina, Arkansas, Alaska. I mean, that's in their range, but the Democrats are running smart campaigns. They're running against. I saw it when I was in Alaska last month, Mark Begich, who's the Democratic senator there, his commercial say, "I'm the one guy who's going to stand up to President Obama." And this seems kind of funny coming from a Democrat, but in a ruby red state like Alaska, you have to do that. So the Democrats know they're in trouble. They know what they have to do. They could all go down. Look, I mean, the waves of 2006, the waves of 2010, we didn't really see happening until October. So, you know, we still, as we said, it's still August. It's still like 75 days to go, and a lot can happen. But right now, I don't see it's doable, but it's not a done deal.
Right.
Do we expect any of the potential candidates for 2016 to make any sort of formal announcement before the November election, or is that something that is more appropriate and we'll wait until after the November election?
Well, there used to be a time, I mean, when you think of like John F. Kennedy back in 1960, he didn't announce until January of 1960.
Yeah,
I mean, so back then you didn't have to do it years in advance. I suspect you're not going to see any kind of announcement before November. I think all the focus is going to be on that. But as Hillary Clinton said, she's not going to make any kind of decision or announcement until next year. But I suspect that after November 4th, you're going to see more and more candidates coming forward with some kind of declaration.
Congress is on summer recess, I believe, until after Labor Day.
A deserved recess.
When they come,
work very hard.
When they come back, are they going to do anything? They're going to be there just in person only, and any true legislative action could come in a lame duck session after the November election?
Well, you know, there are infrastructure problems and there are things like that that I think they are on the same page on, but the key issues that everybody's been talking about, I don't see happening. Everybody says, well, we can't do it because it's an election year. And, you know, we've been saying that for years now. It's kind of, you just wonder why people run for Congress, considering the fact that very little gets done. The 113th Congress may be the least productive Congress in history, if not recent memory. And maybe there's going to be something to be done in a lame duck session in late November, but right now, you know, even the parties are not on the same page. The Democrats are not on the same page on trade. The Republicans are not on the same page on immigration. So if their own parties can't get together, I don't see how the D's and the R's are going to get together as well. So it's a gloomy prospect, and I don't know how it changes. I mean, and again, you know, there was an article in the New York Times today saying that the best thing that could happen to Hillary Clinton is that if the Republicans win the Senate, and then she could run against Congress. I mean, right now, it's, you know, the Democrats have the Senate, Republicans have the House. It's just a mess.
Well, that's what, yeah, people are going to wait and see, you know, who is running the Senate come next January. And that's going to have a whole lot to do with what some of these presidential candidates are saying, particularly on the Democratic side.
Right, and that's why a lot of people said that perhaps President Obama had an opportunity that he lost because, but even if he gets something done in the Senate, the Republican House has been battling him tooth and nail from day one. So unless there's a national outcry saying that something has got to be done, I mean, you think of the children who were gunned down in Sandy Hook, Connecticut, and if gun legislation didn't come after that, then what is going to move the American people, I wonder?
Well, Ken, we're going to let you go so you can practice your parallel parking.
My mugshot.
We've been talking with political junkie Ken Rudin about all things politics. He'll join us again next month. You'll find links to his website and podcast at WVXU.org. Thanks, Ken.
Thanks, guys.
Thanks.
And thanks for listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. Archives of our programs are available on our website. Producer for today's program was Pete Reitmeier. Our technical director was Bruce Ellis. Here and Now is coming up next on 91.7 WVXU. With Howard Wilkinson, I'm Jay Hanselman.